नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्सा। I tie up a few loose ends from yesterday. I suddenly realized that I had left off one little simile for redeeming values in people. It's a very nice one. You remember this notion from yesterday of since you are the beneficiary of it, if you have a problem with a person, it's always an uncomfortable experience, to whatever degree you have it, and it's to your benefit and your profit to get over it one way or the other. And so one of the resorts is to just ignore whatever is unusable in the person or difficult to process and focus on what is usable. So I mentioned the nature of thirst and using water in a pond, had slime and water flowers, and then getting right down to drinking out of the hoof print of a cow, if you have to, if it means survival, you just have to do it. And however, back up the road there, when the person has good behavior and they're at peace and calmness from time to time, and it's verbally they have unskillful behavior. Similarly for that is a monk, and these robes are traditionally made out of patches, and where you get your robes are the highly recommended place is the dump or also a cemetery. Highly recommended to get the cloth off, wrapping cloth off a corpse, cut it up, use it for your robes. So, and monks still do that in Thailand. Very common to, if you're invited to a funeral, one of the gifts is some cloth. Sometimes it's in villages. It's actually the cloth that is the body has been wrapped in. They'll give that to you. And you can go off and wash it and dye it and make a robe with it. But now it becomes rather symbolic. Now they like to invite monks to two funerals, and they have prepackaged kind of cloth, which they touch on the body, then hand you the prepackaged cloth. Of course, that is a reminder of, it's very helpful for the monk also, non-discriminating, making use of whatever you can find anywhere. It relieves you from all the preoccupation with having, you know, this and that kind of clothes. Anything that's lying around, any kind of rags will do, you know, to cut them up, sew them into a robe, dye them. It's a nice liberation from the preoccupations people have with clothes and so forth. But one of the similes is, you know, say that the person has some useful areas. The monk is walking along the road, sees a piece of cloth which is has been well worn and so forth lying there, but it's useful in some ways, parts of it useful, so he puts his right foot on one side and his left foot on the other, and then he tears out the middle section of the cloth, the usable section that still has good tread and so forth, and then he takes that and goes along and he uses that later to sew into his robe. So that is how you can view a person who is has a, you know, unskillful in terms of speech. You just tear out the usable portion of the person, the good part, and take that along. Don't want to waste things. You can sew that right into your life experience and your mosaic of the people that you know. Just cut out the bad part and keep the usable part. That's the simile that I missed from the list. It's a very nice set of images. There's obviously a lot of good artwork that could be done on these similes. There's just there are literally there must be over 1,000 similes in the canon. And it's nature just to stick it on the refrigerator, especially when you're having a problem with somebody. Picture a nice, I can't even cartoon-like area of you tearing a piece of cloth out of a person with their name Bob written on there. Bob's good points. Nobody will understand the cartoon but you. Or you diving into a slime-covered pond. And the ripples can say Susan or something. Or the hoof print. So these are all, you know, have to be kept up. Of course, these are preliminaries. This idea is the preliminaries of moving towards. We really want to be at peace and have no problem with the world. And in order to get that, we can't ignore the rest of our life. We can't just hope to come to a meditation retreat and then just sit down and laser-like concentration appear. You have to realize it by arranging the preliminaries that you free yourself from these things. Look over the whole of your life and the areas that you have trouble with, the sticky parts of life. It just doesn't occur to the ordinary person also what is hanging them up in life and why their minds are agitated, preoccupied, nervous. If they go away from the situation, they may find after a long time that the mind settles down. They may not even realize why. Why is the mind calm sometimes and not others? They may not put it together. Entanglement in the world in terms of aversion. Of course, the other entanglement is in terms of interest, the opposite. And these are, again, it's very important to remember the preliminaries to let go of that. However pretty certain aspects of the world are, same times there's something about it that becomes burdensome. And to have the mind stuck in the world, and to have to rely for your gratification from the sensory hits. So we have the opposite side of the coin: unwise attention to the beautiful. This is, of course, the second hindrance, interest in the sense, what the sense data brings you. And it is not just the sensory world. As I mentioned yesterday, we're not just closing our eyes or closing our ears. We don't do that. We don't go into necessarily sensory deprivation chambers, although it's not a bad idea either. Might be good to try spending some time in an absolutely blacked out room with no sound. It is not exactly sensory deprivation. But the problem is, again, not... you could have a problem with a blacked-out room that had no sound in it. You could find some reason to complain. Certainly lots of people would complain that there's no light in there. So you could find aversion in there. That's unwise attention to some aspect of it. You could also get very attached to it in a sensorial way. You can get sensorially attached to the feeling of blackness, darkness. Then you require it. So we don't want to pin ourselves down too much on arranging sensory conditions perfectly. But certainly, we want to make some basic selections as well as we can in the world, but the world, of course, is not in control very well, so things show up at the at interesting times. The fact that things show up at interesting times has a name for it in Buddhist teaching. It's called Mara. Mara is the magical aspect of the universe that seems to, when you don't want certain things to happen, they happen. When you want certain things to happen, they don't happen. And then unwisely, you want certain things to happen, and the universe goes along with you. provides it. So that's Mara. It shows up even in a dark room, no sounds. We have to deal with Mara through wisdom. We can't just arrange the world. The only place where you're safe from Mara, at least temporarily, is you go off the Mara's radar screen in jhana, deep absorption. As where Mara becomes bewildered, cannot find you. Where did he go? That's a disappearing act. It's the only place you're safe. However, Mara will be waiting for you when you come out. So that great simile, a coyote, a turtle on the road. Turtle, the coyote comes along. Turtle withdraws the legs and tail and head into the shell. And the coyote bites at the shell, gnaws at the shell, throws it up in the air, moves around, cannot get the turtle out. So then the coyote loses interest eventually and just moves on. That is withdrawal into absorption. You withdraw the five senses into the cell, into the shell. There you're safe. Mara, the coyote, cannot get you. Of course, you got to come out sometime. And that's the problem with absorption as well. It's it's only temporary. So we want to find eventually some place that has permanent safety from the coyote, the dangers of existence. So the other side of the coin is this interest in the sensory pleasures, and that is the second hindrance. The simile you probably remember from previous retreats is that a basic idea is that attachment to the sensory things is the same experience as going into debt, and that freedom, when you let go of that sensory attachment, the same kind of sense of relief that one has of getting out of debt. Similarly, it's very interesting. I had just given it in general terms, but it's it has a little more to it. The simile in detail is that a man goes into business, and he thinks to himself, in the business is successful, and he's hoping that what he's hoping for is that he can eventually get out of debt. That he took a loan to get into this business. So when he gets out of debt, he's very happy because he can not only hasn't got this burden on him, but he can also support his wife. And so it's an interesting aspect to the simile, is that when you are preoccupied with getting your needs met from the sensory world, which is a busy, it's busy. It takes a lot of time and effort, and it's fairly low return. It takes a lot of investment, and literally you have to invest money in order to get satisfaction. If you like music, well, you're going to have to pay for it. Especially as your tastes become more refined, you have to go buy these CDs, you're going to have to go to concerts, you're going to have to invest time, effort, money. If you like art, you like music, movies, books, all these things, you have to pay for it in terms of time, money, effort, all these things. So it drains your resources, and you're in debt to them. If you find an alternative way of being, a peaceful way of being without this, then you are discharging that debt you have, and you have, and what he says, left over. I not only have enough for myself, but I also have plenty left over for my wife. That means that you have energy left over for others. You're now more outwardly, you're interested in the concern for others. You don't have such a lot of energy going into your satisfaction of your own small needs. You're hanging on sensual rewards. So it's by getting out of this that you realize that what was first conceived of as a pleasure is actually a debt. You're in debt. And the same relief that comes to a person when the debt is ended comes to you. And the energy left over will be not only for yourself, but also you'll have enough to share with others. That interest business is what it's the interest. The mortgage hardly gets paid down. It's the interest sitting there. Paying it off somewhere. The energy is being squandered in huge amounts. Not direct. So there are a few similes that I'd like to actually. I brought a book along that I'd like to give in the words of the Buddha regarding sensual things. And nature, this is a little reflection that the Buddha had sitting there one night on sensual desire. I've heard that on one occasion the Blessed One was staying near Savatthi in Jetis Grove, and Atapindika's Park. Now, on that occasion, the Blessed One was sitting out in the open in the pitch black of the night while oil lamps were burning. Many flying insects were meeting their downfall and misfortune in those oil lamps. Seeing this, the Buddha exclaimed, "Rushing headlong, missing what is worthwhile, bringing on one new bond after another, like insects falling into the flame. Some are intent only on what is seen and heard." But that's one of the verses. Only, this is basing your life on that superficial thing of the only world for some people is just what is seen and heard. There is no other world. There's no other alternative reality. If you live like that, you live like the moths, that flicker around these lights but get burned up in these lights. So remember the notion the Buddha said that the ill will is a great stain, but easily gotten rid of. As far as the sensory realm, he calls it a lesser stain. This sensory involvement, getting our fruits of our life out of this, it's a lesser stain. Of the three things, greed, hatred, and delusion, greed is the least problematic. It's not many of the actions that we have are not conducive to really bad results in the future. They're not conducive to particularly good results. It's a low return kind of investment. There is a little pleasure in it. There is some redeeming value in it, but not that much. Its great problem is that it's the difficulty of getting free of it. It's really sticky. So it's a lesser fault, but very difficult to get over. So one of the, probably you'll find your mind inclining to, if you manage after a few days in a retreat to get over irritability, ill will, aversion, and so forth. The next one that comes up is, of course, this thinking about the sensory world, a little bit of longing for the sensory world. Maybe at first, when you come to a retreat, there's a sense of relief in getting out of it, just glad to be away from it. But then the senses come back to life. That is the nature of things. Your jaded senses begin to come back to life, and they start to be interested, thirst. Of course, it's not the eyeball that comes back to life. It's the eye consciousness that comes back to life, and it's habitual. It has habitual power to it, so it has a tendency to seek. Again. So, as it's come back to life, you will start to see that it's a diversion from where you want to go. It pulls you again and again. It's a strong habit pattern back into that. That's the problem with the senses. Is that if you thought there was nothing else in existence, then I guess there would be no point in talking about the problem of the senses. It would just be a matter of how most skillfully to arrange your time to get maximum number of sensory hits. And in fact, that is what you if lots of books out there, lots of magazines out there, lots of television programs out there, lots of little seminars and clinics, you know exactly that, that the whole idea of the thing is to how you can arrange your life to get more sensory hits out of it, to squeeze a little more, extract a little more pleasure from life. And lots of people would, what's wrong with that? What's the problem with that? If that was all there is, and many people assume that is the case, then there wouldn't be anything wrong with it. That'd be the only thing to do, and it's I'm just a little bit dismaying. It's a little bit unfortunate. But since there are alternatives, this is where we begin to understand the nature of the disappointing and difficult to get to extract enough pleasure. They're just small on a low level and disappointing. The feedback is disappointing on them. Clinging to sense pleasures, to sensual ties, seeing no blame in the fetter, never will those tied up in the fetter cross over the flood so great and wide. And that is, again, most people will be fairly open to the idea that there's problems with anger, problems with hatred, it's an unwanted kind of thing. They're fairly accessible to that, although not everybody would agree. It's not always easy to make the argument even that there's anything wrong with anger. But when it comes to sense pleasures, people tend to think, oh, well, you're just trying to keep us from having fun. You're just kind of trying to be a wet blanket on things. But anybody, the thoughtful person is not the problem. We're not coming at it from a moralistic point of view, puritanical kind of view. Most of the people who are saying there's something wrong with sense pleasures have already explored the matter and kind of come away a bit disappointed, or more than a bit disappointed. They thought, well, is that it? This is not a very satisfactory situation. It's not like if you abstain from sense pleasures after you die, you'll go to heaven. That is not the complaint. The complaint is that in the here and now, it's a bit of a desert, and with just very few oases, and not enough. You'd have to be fairly shallow to imagine that's enough. People just find it just too many unsatisfactory elements to it. So that's the more or less that's the attitude of the trouble of the sense realms. It's not that we're trying to make throw a wet blanket on the party. It's just that we find that the party is not all that good. I think we're getting bored with the party. It's not that good, and we're also checking our pockets, seeing, realizing how much we're spending on this party, and it's just not giving back what it should. That's intelligence. That's wisdom. That's being able to assess the situation. It's not the candle is not worth the game in this case. So that's why we're looking for the alternative lifestyle, alternative to the senses. So that's the kind of the approach that the Buddha gives, and he gives it in some very explicit similes. They're very actually quite powerful, so I kind of introduce you to the idea so you're a little bit open to these these similes, because they really portray the world as a very not very satisfactory. The little things that we can get from the world are very problematic. Here is one of them, very beautiful. Suppose a dog, overcome with weakness and hunger, were to come across a slaughterhouse, and there a skilled butcher or butcher's apprentice were to fling him a chain of bones, thoroughly scraped, without any flesh, smeared with blood. What do you think? Would the dog, gnawing on that chain of bones, thoroughly scraped, without any flesh, smeared with blood, appease his weakness and hunger? Bhikkhu's reply, no, Lord. And why is that? Because the chain of bones is thoroughly scraped, without any flesh, and smeared with blood. the dog would get nothing but weariness and vexation. In the same way, householder, and by the way, this one is directed to the householders, not to the monks. This is, sometimes we think, oh, only monks have to worry about that sensory thing. They're stepping out of the sensory world. These similes, these teachings are addressed to householders about the problematic, vexatious, insufficient nature of trying to get something out of the world, get some hits out of the world. It's like gnawing on a bone with no meat on it. In the same way, householder, a noble disciple considers this point. Again, he's saying that this is the way an enlightened person thinks, considers this point. He's not saying that everybody understands this. He's saying that a thoughtful, a wise person looks at it this way. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a chain of bones of much stress, much despair, and great drawbacks. Seeing this with right discernment as it is, then avoiding the obsession with the variety of the world, the variety of the senses, one develops equanimity coming from singleness, dependent on singleness, where sustenance, clinging for the baits of the world, ceases entirely. One stops distracting oneself with the diversity through the six senses. When they talk about multiplicity, is that you're channeling it off into the senses. And this is, again, like the tortoise withdraws into the center, into singleness. You drop the outer five senses, you turn to the inner. And here, because you have singleness, here you find satisfaction away from the drawbacks, the many drawbacks of the world. One thing is, it doesn't cost you any money. I mean, just to sit down, if you have the skill, it transforms your economics in a drastic way. It's very, very good. You're getting your supply. You don't have to go through the merchants of the world, the merchants who merchant the sensory things, who control these things. Your supply is direct. No second, there's no intermediary. So you, by cultivating this gratification from withdrawal into meditation, you have access to higher quality supply, and you don't have to go through anybody else. So the economics, in terms of energy and time and money, much, much better. In fact, Mara is, in a sense, like advertising agencies and companies. You know that they have to spend a lot of money on advertising and promotion of their products to keep you interested, to keep you believing that you need these things to be happy. Mara is a perfect manifestation of Mara. Mara also does this. Because Mara knows that Mara is considered to be, is portrayed as this kind of merchant who is gets their satisfaction out of how much stuff sells in the world. So Mara is depicted not like in the Christian notion of Satan living in hell, sort of doing evil things, but Mara actually lives in heaven. Mara is from, lives in one of the nice, very nice mansion in Upper Rosedale. Just like the people who really run the world, they don't live in the ghetto. Often we get our attention is directed toward the dangers of these bad, violent people and everything, but who really has the power, who really runs the show, and who is invested in the fact that you stay interested in the world, you stay interested in the product. That's the nature of Mara. That's why Mara tends to want to interfere with any attempt to divorce yourself from the interest in the products. That's why Mara tends to in meditation retreats, Mara tends to show up in the mind in various ways, distract you through, it's the same kind of basic ideas of advertising. You can get the person's attention by shock value, you know, or by attractive value, or the kind of information infomercials, you know, where they basically raise your anxiety. If you don't get the insurance policy now, you know what could happen down the road and so forth. Or connection. The fun life, the enjoyable life is connected. You're on a sail, they're on a sailboat, looking like they're having a lot of fun, but they have to have a can of beer in their hand, right? So it's all of these kind of connected images in the mind. Where does all this advertising and everything come from? It comes from the basic universal characteristics of the ordinary human mind. And it does the job. It works the same way as all of these things. It produces this information, so you have to be aware of what's going on. Trying to pull you away, if you discover this, you will cease to be a good, productive customer in the chain, in the food chain. hard to deal with you. There'll be lots of criticism from those who want to make money off you. Not just in the literal sense, but symbolically, part of the interactive nature of the world, Mara's sort of influence in the world, is that you're useful only as long as you have these addictions, cravings, desires. You become, they don't know what to do with you when you don't respond. So there's a strong investment in keeping you. It's this little plot to get once you start the teen smoking cigarettes, you got them for life, right? If they don't get you before 25 or so, it's unlikely they're going to get you. Only like 1% starts later on. So Mara knows to start young and keep you interested. So these are the forces within us. Mara are just natural psychological processes that pull us this way, force that way. Keep advertising to us in the most interesting way. We think we're over something that we never wanted to see it again. We couldn't care less. I remember a story about Ajahn Viradamo. He's a senior Canadian monk. Early days in Thailand, he'd been, I think he was in third year engineering at the University of Toronto when he went off traveling around. That was 30 years ago. Never came back. He ended up staying in Thailand, becoming a monk, and he's still a monk almost 30 years later. But he thought his self-assessment was that as far as things like food went, you know, ordinary kind of thing, he felt he could sort of take it or leave it, you know. Like if he opens the fridge and there's a can of Coke there, so forth, he felt, well, you know, I can take it or leave it. I'll just take it. So as long as one is not in a situation where one cannot get these things, one does not know, one thinks one can take it or leave it, but we do take it. So he was telling a story on himself. After he got to Thailand, spent in ordained, maybe a year or two in the robes, shipped out to one of the branch monasteries of one of Ajahn Chah's branch monasteries. And this is around 1970, 71. At that time, these monasteries, well, they still are very austere, but it's in the poorest area of the country, and it's the heat can be scorching hot up there, and you're just in a little tin roof monk's cabin. There's nothing there. You just and at that time they didn't even have tea time. They just have one meal a day. Occasionally people would show up. Villagers would show up, and they would bring a little ice basket with some drinks in it, including Coca-Cola, which is a very expensive gift to offer the monks in that area. It's almost a day's wages. A can of Coke would be a day's wages. So when a party like that would come, then they would come and see the abbot, and after he talked to them for a while, they might ring a bell, and monks in the area would hear that bell, and they would come over, and then there would be a drink offered to them. So this was very intermittent. Maybe, you know, this would happen once a week or so, sometimes twice in a week, you know, really exciting. Sometimes 2 weeks would go by, you know. So Ajahn Viradamo finds himself, he's saw, he was on his way back to his kuti, and he saw at the corner of his eye some people coming into the monastery, and he stopped. And he looked, because they were carrying something. His attention was caught. He went, oh, they're carrying a basket. It's not just a basket, it's a plastic. Oh, drinks. There must be drinks in there. So then he thought, well, better not go back to my kuti because I might not hear the bell. I better just hang around here. So they come and they do this. And there's he's walking meditation over there, just kind of checking on it every now and then, seeing. You know, this is, he's a growing man, comes from a good family in Toronto and everything. He's the guy that can take it or leave it, you know. He's just hours of his day, he's waiting for the drink, you know, see what they got in there. Finally, you know, he's hanging about, they're talking to the abbot, this and that. Finally, somebody rings a bell. Ding, he's there. Well, I just happened to be passing by. And then, it's a can of Coke, and it's like his dream has come. It's just like he realizes how much it really means to him. It's the whole scale of values. Your attachments to the sensory world is strong. It's just you can... Your senses are jaded. You get things whenever you want them. And you have sometimes you can turn it down, you've had enough of it. But you'd be surprised how strong those strings are once you get removed from that. You'd be waiting about, waiting, keeping an eye, deducing. Yeah? You see the crows out there on the roof there, watching various possibilities of going to that fountain and what's on the ground and so forth. Become very interested in stuff. So your senses come back to life. And it's amazing how humiliating the experience is. So you're in debt to these things, and it's good to realize it and to want not to be in debt. As this kind of thing fades out, you really have a profound sense of freedom just to be. You just rejoice in that all the time. It's one of the most, when you reflect on it, you're not aware of it all the time, but every now and then when you reflect on it, having gotten over some sort of sensory attachments, the relief is just, it's one of the best things about the whole practice, is to be free of those things. Not the aversion, everything. I mean, the aversion is it's a very clear, unpleasant experience, but to get over that indebtedness, the sensory world, and have some alternative is just to be set free from this. A couple more of these things because they're so brilliant, and I don't think you've heard these ones before, at least from me, in any of my retreats. Now suppose a vulture, a kite, or a hawk were to take off, having seized a lump of flesh, and other vultures, kites, or hawks, following right after it, were to tear at it and pull at it. What do you think, if the vulture, kite, or hawk were not quickly to drop that lump of flesh, would it meet with death from that cause, or with death-like pain? Yes, Lord. In the same way, householder, a noble disciple considers this point. The Blessed One has compared sensuality to a lump of flesh, of much stress, of much despair, and great drawbacks. And then he develops the equanimity coming from singleness, dependent on singleness, where sustenance and clinging for the baits of the world ceases entirely. That has to do with the nature, the other problematic side of things you want, competition for it. You're up against, you want the job, you're competing. You want the house, you're competing. You want the thing, you're competing. This is the other dreary aspect of the whole thing, is the competitive, especially this society is very competitive. Really, brings you to the end of your rope if you're a sensitive person. You don't really want to be competing with people all the time, especially over a lump of meat. So the things that you're competing over are really quite... anybody who's sensitive from time to time just thinks... there's got to be a better way. You can have the thing. I don't want to compete for it anymore. or we're driven by competitiveness. It's very problematic. A particular antidote to that, of course, that's one of the sublime abidings that doesn't get enough rating, should be up in neon lights in retreats. We always talk about metta, compassion, sometimes about equanimity, but mudita, this joy and the joy of others, should be given more play, especially in this society. It's the one to practice to reduce a sense of competitiveness and envy. Again and again, to learn to enjoy others' successes and well-beings. It lets you off the hook. You don't have to succeed yourself. You can just sit around and enjoy everybody else's success. It's a great thing, you know. You just don't have to do it yourself. Just enjoy theirs. Now, if you have this capacity, then it's all of that deprivation that is built into when they stimulate this competitiveness, and envy, and a very uncomfortable experience to have those emotions. They dissolve with this mudita. You just can enjoy everybody else's success, just as if it was you. When you go to hear the concert, you just identify, say, what's different? That fellow's hands play the piano marvelously. Identify them as your hands. It's just a matter of mind, isn't it? If you think they're his hands and not yours, and you think, I wish I had, I could do that. But if you think, those are my hands, then you can congratulate yourself. Be happy with that. It's just an act of mind, isn't it? Transference of identity. To identify with. If it's your son, your child, your husband, your somebody who you transfer your identity to, then when they succeed, you feel great. So why do you only transfer your identity to a limited number of people? Learn to expand that. Do it to anybody who succeeds. Identify with them. Transfer your identity to them. That frees you from envy, competitiveness, all these uncomfortable experiences. Now, who wants to be fighting over a lump of meat? People do end up fighting over that. There's a beautiful simile as far as bird behavior goes too, because you'd see it. I was looking when I stepped out for the walking meditation. There's three or four crows out there, and they were having a problem with each other over something. Although later on, in my walking meditation, I looked up, and it changed my perception of crows. I haven't seen them do this before. They were really very. They were sitting on the edge of the building up there, and there was four of them. And one of them was just hanging out on the corner of the building, and the other three were standing beside each other. And I saw something that I hadn't seen before. One of them sort of said something to the other crow. He opened his mouth and rack, rack. And the other crow walked over and put something right in his mouth and walked away. And I thought, wow, that's really I haven't seen them share like that before. I didn't know that they did that. They must be from the same family there. But then I thought, that's impressive. He just said something and it came right over and just put it right in his mouth. And it's not the baby. You know, I can understand it when the mother is feeding the baby. They do that with the worms and so forth. But these are full grown. They're all about the same size. Then they sat beside each other, and one of them, I thought he was going to peck the other one, but the other one just stood there. And I was actually just picking through the feathers of the other one, looking for, relieving him of mites and so forth. So he would carefully, and right around his eyes and everything, and the other one would sort of tilt his head to the side, and the other one would very gently pick off things off the flesh. And then the one on the other side also, he'd also be involved every now and then, just selectively grooming the other one, just a very beautiful cooperative experience. I was thinking, how do they know how to do that? Why does one know what the other one is just about to do? It leans over with its beak and it surrenders. And it's, why do they do this? What's the benefit for this? What I have to think of is that these aren't crows. You know, if you think of them as crows, then you think, how can they know to do this? You start thinking of sort of evolutionary reasons for this, that there must be some survival benefit from one picking the bugs off the other, you know. Why would they do that? But actually, then I thought, well, you don't think in those ways. What are those crows? Those crows are the universe. The universe taking care of itself. Why should it matter? You know, it's a very sophisticated piece of the universe there. Why should I think that the universe is stupid or something? Can't think of these things. The universe is very intelligent. Designs this right into it. That's a manifestation of the universe. The universe taking care of itself in its very sophisticated ways. We just have to, the thing that's watching the universe take care of itself is the universe. The universe watching the universe take care of itself and kind of amazed that the universe could be so smart. And I think, wait a sec, who's watching? You know, it's the universe admiring itself for being so smart. Well, why not? As soon as you start to universalize, identify, you know, extend yourself over into these things, then you realize there's no, you are those things. You are one with these things. So this is a very nice rewarding attitude to have. You lose your sense of separateness and you can appreciate that there are aspects of the universe, very positive, find them, and certain perspectives that you look on certain things that alleviate the tension. Why is there tension in us? Why do we suffer? What is the experience of suffering? It's just telling us something. It's saying you're doing something wrong. You're failing to recognize who you are. You are attributing a sense of identity, a limited sense of identity, to yourself and to others. And therefore, you're suffering. I always do this to you if you fail to remember who you are. If you do not extend your identity out, including all beings, if you look at it that way, the pain goes away. If you restrict your sense of identity, imagine that you are self-made, that you are separate, that you are always experiencing.